This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Touro University. Whether you're looking for a career in business, finance, or accounting, health sciences, medicine, or dentistry, Touro has a program for you. At Touro, you'll get more of everything that's important to you. More career options, more personal attention, and more accelerated pathways to leading graduate and professional programs in multiple fields. Touro offers a high-quality education surrounded by people with your values and all the training you need to succeed in your chosen profession. On this episode, I was joined by Dr. Alan Kadish, president of Touro University, and Rabbi Dr. Michael Schmidman, dean of the Touro Graduate School of Jewish Studies, where students enjoy close interaction with faculty, superior instruction, and a rigorous curriculum as they pursue Master of Arts degrees in Jewish Studies, focusing on either Jewish history or Jewish education or a PhD in Jewish studies. To learn more, visit www.touro.edu. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Svarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Dr. Alan Kadish, who is the president of Touro College and University System, and Rabbi Dr. Michael A. Schmidman, the Dean and Victor J. Sulmanowitz Professor of Jewish History at Touro Graduate School of Jewish Studies and the editor of Touro University Press. And we'll be discussing their new book that they co-authored together called The Jewish Intellectual Tradition, A History of Learning and Achievement. So I think we should start off. I usually ask the listeners, the guests, about their background. So I guess whichever one you want to start off, I'll ask you both about your background. So we can give the listeners a little bit of, brief description.
Okay, so Nachi, it's a pleasure and an honor to be your guest. I hail from Brooklyn, specifically Canarsie, where my father, Avi Mari, Harav Shmuel Schmidman, Zatzal, who was a musmach from Mir in Europe, was the Mar Da'asra. He was rabbi of Congregation of Shalom, which was known as the Kevelson Shul, for over 50 years, and a Magid Shir at BTA, the high school that I attended. I then studied at YU, learned at Yeshiva Sarben Yitzchak Elchanan, where I had the schus of learning various masechtas and Yoredeya with the Rav Zatzal, Rav Soloveitchik, then an MA degree at Hebrew University, and subsequently a PhD degree in medieval Jewish intellectual history at Harvard University, where I had the singular privilege of studying closely with Harav Professor Yitzchak Isidor Tversky Zatzal, and also had the signal honor of co-authoring a book with him. It was a Hebrew textbook for the Open University, Universitat Ptucha, on the Rambam. It's entitled Halacha V'Hagut Kavei Yisrael B'Mishnato Shel HaRambam. While in Cambridge, served as Orthodox rabbi at Harvard Hillel. Then I taught at University of Cincinnati, then Yeshiva University. And in 1981, the founder and first president of Touro, Dr. Kadish's predecessor, Dr. Lander Azal, invited me to be the first director of the Touro Graduate School of Jewish Studies. And that's where I still am. As you noted in my title, I'm somehow still dean after all these years, and a professor of Jewish history. During my tenure at Touro, I also served concurrently during certain periods of time as editor of tradition and as rabbi of Congregation Ketzet Torah, which is also known as the Romer Shul in Teaneck, New Jersey. So you might say that my career has been a blend, Baruch Hashem and B'siyata D'Shmaya, of Rabbanus and academia, but primarily the latter.
Okay, so now, Dr. Kadish, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
So my background is actually quite different, except for the fact that I was also born in Brooklyn, in Crown Heights. I grew up in Queens, went to MTA and Columbia and medical school at Albert Einstein. And then I trained at Harvard and at the University of Pennsylvania as something called a cardiac electrophysiologist, which means I took care of people with heart rhythm disturbances. And then spent about 25 years as a faculty member at the University of Pennsylvania, at Michigan, and the longest period of time at Northwestern, where I ran a research institute, did some administration, and worked as a physician. 12 years ago, Dr. Lander, the same Dr. Lander, who was 94 at the time, contacted me through an intermediary and asked me to come to Touro. And it seemed like an exciting institution and a great opportunity. And so I've been at Touro for the last 12 years. And I do a little bit of cardiology research, but with the help of people like Michael and Simcha Fishbane, who helped us with some organizational things on the book, I've also written some things about in the Jewish area, and was very excited to work with Michael on this book, The Jewish Intellectual Tradition.
Okay, so let's hope.
Mutual. The feeling's mutual.
Okay, good. So let's talk about the book a little bit. Obviously, like you said, you both have different backgrounds. So you approach this book, it's like this unique blend of two different areas putting together this book. So I think we should start off, actually, let's give a broad overview. I mean, what exactly is the book about? Like I said, it's called The Jewish Intellectual Tradition, but as a broad overview, what is this book about?
So I think to try to understand what the book is about, I think it's important to understand what we mean by an intellectual tradition. And the intellectual history is basically a history of ideas and people who make ideas. And I think that's important to try to understand the focus of the book. It's not a history book, and it's not a book about the Jewish people per se. It's about the history of ideas that have contributed to Judaism. So it's not going to be primarily about Jewish communities and people in the communities. It's primarily about the people who made ideas that constituted Judaism. So that's the first thing to think about. And what we did is we confined ourselves primarily to the last 1,000 years, when a lot of what makes up modern Judaism was developed intellectually. And we looked, and there are two parts of the book. In the first part of the book, we talked about what we defined as different periods in the Jewish intellectual tradition. And I'll let Michael talk a little bit more about this, but we picked figures and libraries from each of those periods to try to determine what was going on in terms of the history of ideas in the book. In the second part of the book, building on some themes from the first part, we tried to define what was unique about the Jewish intellectual tradition, what different things we could pick out. And we came up with four general principles, which we can talk about in a few minutes. But each of those principles alone is not unique to the Jewish tradition or the Jewish intellectual tradition. But the combination of those, in some ways that we talk about, we thought was. So that's how we sort of define the Jewish intellectual tradition. And then at the very end of the book, we try to learn some universal lessons for education, since we're both educators, from the Jewish intellectual tradition. And so that's a brief overview of the book. I wouldn't say we expected it to be an easy read. It's a serious book, but one which we hope makes some new points that will be important for understanding Judaism, for understanding the Jewish intellectual tradition, and for learning some lessons about education and life in general.
Yes, nothing. Susan, if I may elaborate a bit. I would add that it was Alan, Dr. Kadish, who identified specifically these four salient traits of the Jewish intellectual tradition that comprised the structure for part two of the book. And I heard him lecture on that topic soon after he assumed the presidency of Touro. I took a keen interest in it, and we collaborated. My job was to flesh out the historical context primarily for those salient traits of the tradition. And so the first part of the book tries to trace the tradition through different historical periods, different geographical regions, and quite diverse genres of this tradition. And we utilized a literary device in the process of exploring the history of this tradition. Specifically, we tried to imagine and recreate libraries of key figures in different periods of Jewish history. What Sfarim, what literary works, what languages would be represented in these libraries, and what directions might the interaction of those volumes present for future creativity, or even sometimes for potential conflict between Judaism and the ideas of the surrounding culture. And so, for example, we constructed libraries of Rav Shmuel HaNagid in the 11th century in Spain, or the Ramban in 13th century Spain, or Leone Modena, that eclectic and charismatic figure of late 16th and early 17th century Italy, or Rav Hirsch in 19th century Germany, or Professor Harry Wilson in 20th century America. In all of these cases, we have a library as a starting and or focal point to carry out our survey of the history and evolution of the Jewish intellectual tradition. And that allows us to then extract those specific salient traits of the tradition in accordance with Dr. Kadish's identification of those traits. And if I may elaborate on one more aspect of this, in doing so, I think one of the fascinating parts of the first section of the book in particular is the way in which we try to follow the evolution of these diverse genres of Jewish literature throughout Jewish history. Because as you trace the Jewish historical tradition from antiquity through the medieval and modern periods, you find Jews are active in a very impressive array of disciplines. You cannot but be dazzled by the scope and breadth of this tradition. And these diverse genres include, for example, just a couple of minutes on that, and I'll turn it over to Alan. But you find, as you would expect, the study of Talmud and its associated literature. That's not surprising because study of the literature of Chazal is the mainstream of Jewish intellectual concern from post-Talmudic times until modern times. So it's not surprising to find, for example, in the 11th century, at the same time, you have three contemporaries, the Rif in Spain, composing his abridgment of the Talmud, his Talmud Katan. In France, Rashi is authoring his classic Perush al Talmud. And in Italy, you have Rav Nassim ben Yechiel composing the Orach, a Talmudic lexicon. They're all of these Rishonim are endeavoring in different and unique ways to do the same thing, to simplify and to systematize the very complex and sophisticated Talmud Bavli, and to make it more accessible to the Jews of Europe so that they may continue this central focus upon Talmud study, so that they could continue to employ new methods, whether the methods of conceptual analysis of the Balei HaTosfos or the Pilpul of the 16th to 18th centuries, or the Brisket Derech of the 19th century, or the contemporary academic study of Talmud in university departments. So it's not surprising to find the genre of Talmud throughout the historical survey of the Jewish intellectual tradition, nor is it surprising to find a biblical study of Mikra. Jews, after all, are the people of the book. You can have a whole debate as to which book that is. Is it the Talmud or is it the Bible? But Jews have always studied Tanakh, sometimes to a greater, sometimes to a lesser degree. It depends where you are geographically and when. But from Rashi and Rashbam and Ibn Ezra and Radak and Ramban to Svarno and Abarbanel to Hirsch and Malbim and the Tziv and Meshechachma to more contemporary methods of Bible study like the Gush Herzog method, a study of Tanakh is a given. But particularly striking in this survey in part one of the book is to what extent Jews have engaged in the study and cultivation of other disciplines, not just Talmud and Tanakh, but also philosophy, for example, where there's a concern throughout the medieval period of trying to harmonize, trying to demonstrate the congruence of the truths of the books of Revelation and the truths of the books of philosophy and science, faith and reason. Or you have mysticism from Merkava mysticism, expressing the attempt to ascend to the vision of the celestial realm akin to what Yechezkel saw, or the Kabbalah of the Zohar or Kabbalah Sari, or down to popular movements today that sometimes incorporate New Age thinking, or scientific thinking, another genre, beginning with For example, Gemara Masech and Sadi Dalet, discussing the origins of day and night, continuing to medieval works on astronomy and math and medicine, Hebrew encyclopedias of science from the 13th century on, like the famous 17th century Maaseh Tuvia of Tuvia Katz of Italy, down to illustrious names in science like Einstein and Sagan and Rabi and Norbert Wiener, or in the social sciences, Durkheim and Freud and Vygotsky, all of them profiled in the book as exhibiting, sometimes very consciously, sometimes less consciously, but all exhibiting the key traits, as we have identified them, of the Jewish intellectual tradition that they inherited. And then you have also poetry. Poetry from the piyut or liturgical compositions of the early centuries of the Common Era to the religious and secular poetry, because secular poetry, Shirei Chol, began to enter the picture in the Spanish period, the 10th to 12th century in Spain, Hanagir, Ibn Gabirol, Halevi, down to a broad range of Jewish novelists in our own day from Haredi to secular. So this is a remarkably broad tradition, and you see in it not just individuals who are talented in a particular discipline, but you see people who are often talented in multiple disciplines. You have Renaissance men way before the Renaissance, people like Rav Shmuel HaNagid or Ibn Ezra or the Rambam. And finally, as we chronicle, there are varying approaches, often passionate in their intensity, to the value of engagement in these other disciplines. It's a debate that's still very much with us. Does one reach a higher madriga of shlemus, of religious perfection, by integrating all of these disciplines with classical study of Torah? Do you integrate the lechem and basar with the tiul bepardes, as the Rambam might say? Or do you concentrate more monolithically on the classical rabbinic texts, hafochba b'hafochba, the kulaba? Or perhaps an approach somewhere in between those two extremes. But in any case, we try to demonstrate that in all of these cases, in all of these camps, there you see the salient traits of the Jewish intellectual tradition.
So before we talk about those specific traits, I just want to comment on a couple of things that Rabbi Schmidman talked about. So one is that we try to take a look in the chapter at the end of the first part of the book with where we see the Jewish intellectual tradition in each of these genres today and where we see it going. But one of the complexities in trying to understand the Jewish intellectual tradition is what happened during the Haskalah, during the Jewish Enlightenment. Because before that time, before the 17th, 18th century, not all Jews were observant, but essentially the Jewish intellectual tradition consisted of a tradition of observant Jews, because either you were an observant Jew or you left the community completely. You assimilated, you intermarried, and you left the community. Starting in the late 17th and 18th centuries, there began to develop a Jewish tradition that wasn't based on traditional observance. And that tradition has complicated what one means by the Jewish intellectual tradition. So, of course, we focus on the Jewish intellectual tradition, which is Torah and Halacha based, but recognize that in the past couple of hundred years, there's a more complex tradition that's developed. And how much of the people who are immersed in that tradition remain part of the tradition, and how many move away from the tradition, where the tradition isn't a major influence on that on their work, is something that we discuss extensively in the book, and there's not always an easy answer to. The other thing I wanted to mention was Rabbi Schmidman mentioned that he heard me lecture. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about the origins of those concepts in the original lecture. And they're actually discussed in the book in the introduction to part two. It was initially based on my interpretation of a Dvar Torah that I actually gave before I came to Torah. And it was trying to really understand how the Torah views intelligence. And so in a quick survey of the Torah's view of intelligence, what I discovered was that more than half the references in the Chumash to intelligence refer to Bezalel as the paradigm of intelligence. And so I want to make two points about that. First, Bezalel's intelligence was multifactorial. He was what, when I grew up, we would call a Renaissance man, and what now, I guess, more politically correctly is referred to as a polymath. But he had to know geometry, mathematics, architecture, engineering, art. So it wasn't enough for him to be an expert. Chemistry wasn't enough for him to be an expert in one single field. And he's considered by the Torah to be the paradigm of intelligence, to suggest that the Torah's view of intelligence is broad-based. But the second thing is those four characteristics that I alluded to earlier were really based on four characteristics by which Bezalel is described. And they are Chachma, Bina, Das, Ulahoros. And there's a lot of course, controversy about how to interpret each of those. In general, the construct that I put together is really based mostly on Rashi, which is that Chachma is acquisition of knowledge, Bina is the ability to reason, Das is one type or another of a more holistic view of intelligence, and Lahoros is the ability to teach. So out of those concepts and with some thought about history, we developed these four areas where the Jewish intellectual tradition, we felt, had some uniqueness. So one was a strong fidelity tradition to tradition, but encouraging creative thinking. So obviously, there's a hierarchy of Jewish knowledge historically. We consider the Tanaim and the Mishnah to be on the highest level, and more recent authorities to be on a lower level. But at the same time, despite that strong fidelity to precedent, we encourage creativity and Divrei Torah and Chidushim in every generation. So there's a unique combination in the Jewish tradition of those elements, which is a strong adherence to tradition, but encouraging creativity. The second piece of knowledge that we talk about is using logic in the pursuit of truth. And the idea that our goal in the tradition is to find truth, but to use precise logical systems to achieve that truth, something which we think trains thinking ability. The third genre is universal literacy. And while today universal literacy may not be unique, during much of the time that the Jewish intellectual tradition developed, universal literacy was not a factor in society. And Vishinantam Bonecha, the need to teach your children, to daven, to learn, resulted in a level of literacy, not 100%, but that was unique among surrounding societies. And we think that that piece of it was very, very important in the development of the Jewish intellectual tradition. And finally, that literacy obviously is fundamentally integrated with teaching, one of Bezalel's unique abilities. But finally, it's this holistic approach to intelligence, which many interpret as a purposeful life, or using your intelligence as a personal life, which is the fourth feature that we focus on. And the idea being that both for intellectual advancement and for personal happiness, having a purpose in life is extraordinarily important. Now, for observant Jews, of course, that purpose in life is to fulfill Hashem's mission for us, to build the world. For those perhaps who aren't observant, but still part of the Jewish intellectual tradition, and whose relationship with God may be more variable than we consider, the idea of bettering humanity and bettering the world as a moral and ethical rather than religious precept also has some value. But essentially, our belief is that those people who think we're here for a higher purpose, who think something beyond themselves, have both greater happiness and greater ability to achieve intellectually, having nothing to do with native intelligence, but just with the application of whatever skills were given to further the intellectual tradition. And that's really those principles that we extract from the Jewish intellectual tradition that we then think, as I said, are very important for education.
Let me just jump in. Let me take a step back for one second here. But how did the book come to be? We'll go more in depth in a second on this. But was it just like Rabbi Schmidman said? He heard you, Dr. Kadish, giving these lectures, and then he thought this was interesting, and he decided to collaborate. I mean, how exactly did this book that maybe the idea, but then how did you decide you're going to get together and write a book on this?
Well, when we talked about it, it was something that I felt passionately about. And I felt that something I've lectured to our students about a number of times. And I thought that sharing that knowledge with others would be helpful when Rabbi Shvindman sort of mentioned that he was interested in it. And it clearly was not going to be something which we could write an article about. It was going to require an in-depth study to try to review the history of the Jewish intellectual tradition and justify what we extracted from it. And so that's how we kind of decided to write a book. Since we both have a day job, it probably took us 5 or 6 years to write the book. But it was a great experience working together with Rabbi Shvindman. And, you know, I don't have a background in academic Jewish studies. And both his intellectual creativity and his background were crucial for making the book happen. And so it was an absolute pleasure. And as I said, I like to think we've produced something that'll be useful to people to learn something about the tradition, but also with practical advice about how to move forward.
I would add that, again, the feeling is mutual. It was quite an honor and a privilege to work with Dr. Kadish. It was his vision, his unique vision, but he was so passionate that he inspired me to join in this endeavor, in this collaboration, and his editing was so insightful and in terms of everything that I contributed to it, it all went through his hands. So it is a collaborative effort, and we do hope that writing it will be of significance to all readers, be they from Jews, secular Jews, non-Jews, who have any interest in Jews and Judaism, or who can perceive through this book the way in which the principles that are identified here could actually be applied universally to further productivity and personal happiness, especially during an age like this, an age of pandemic. I think the lessons of this book are even more vital.
Okay, so we'll get back to history in a minute, but Dr. Kadish, I do want to pick up on one thing you had mentioned before, and I actually saw this in the book. I thought this was a very interesting point, that how these principles, these four principles that you pull out are even, I mean, I'll ask you, were they always present? I mean, you mentioned in the book that these are even present in times of persecution, unlike where other traditions you don't have that. I thought that was an interesting point. Perhaps you want to talk a little bit more about that, why you saw that, something that's a little interesting.
Sure. So if you look at the history of intellectual achievement, not just in the Jewish tradition, but in general, we see that intellectual achievement generally happens in politically and economically powerful societies. And in societies where thinkers can exist in a stable environment. And that's because when you're faced with day-to-day challenges of starvation, persecution, wars, of course, there are exceptions, but in general, it's harder for people to focus on intellectual pursuits. And if you're not fully committed as a life mission to achieving this success, to adding to the history of ideas, it can sometimes be challenging. So if we think, for example, about the great achievements in Western culture, which we're probably a little bit more familiar with, you think about the literature of the Greeks and the Romans, then the Renaissance, and then in modern society, there are people, the creators themselves are not necessarily personally, economically successful, but they exist in stable societies and in stable environments, which allows them to achieve. But our point is that when you believe that what you're doing is a mission from God or is of crucial importance to humanity, you don't let yourself get distracted by what's around you, because you wake up every day and say, this is what I'm here for, this is what I have to achieve, and this is why I have to achieve. So if you look at people who've had personally difficult lives, you still see tremendous achievement. And you see that in people like the Rambam, the Abarbanel, and in more modern figures that have personally disrupted lives, say Chagall. And you see that this idea that we're here for a higher purpose helps drive productivity even in challenging times. And that was one of the things we talked about in the book.
If I could add, in the last chapter of the book, the 11th chapter, we offer 11 recommendations as to universal application of those basic four principles of the Jewish intellectual tradition. And one of the recommendations is indeed an outgrowth of what Dr. Kadish was just elaborating upon. It's generated by the principle of living a purposeful life, and we call it, do not be distracted from your determination to advance and accomplish despite impediments that stand in your way. And the example, the case study that we gave was Rav Avram Saba. Rav Avram Saba was a Darshan and Parshan who was among the Jews expelled from Spain in 1492. He fled to Portugal. Unfortunately, you then had the decree of expulsion in 1496. He tried to leave again. When he came close to Lisbon, he became aware of the decree against possession of any Hebrew books. And so he tells us, here's a quote from him, "Before we reached the city, I buried my manuscripts under the roots of an olive tree." He was then imprisoned for months in Lisbon, managed to escape to Morocco. And after he recuperated from an illness, he was determined to rewrite all his lost manuscripts that he had buried. And we have some of them, Eshkola Kofer. We have his Perushim on Chumash, on Rus, on Esther. This is a clear instance of determination and dedication, defeating disruption and despair.
Right, and I would say that that his Pirush Chumash is Tzor Amor.
I'm sorry, Tzor Amor. It's the other on Anach. You are correct. I've used it many times.
Yeah, just wanted to add that. Okay, so let's now flip over to you, Rav Shmuel, to the little bit of the history, the part one of the book, where you do discuss, like I mentioned, you already mentioned the figures, but I'll just to mention them. So first, you go through Rav Shmuel HaNogid. Then the second chapter is Nachmanides and his library, so Ramban. Then you go through Leon of Modena, Yehuda Aryeh of Modena. I did a podcast episode on him over a year ago, a while back. Mm-hmm. Then you have the Sham Shafal Hirsch, Professor Harry Ocean Wolfson, and then the sixth one you title the Contemporary University Library. So, first of all, why you mentioned this a little bit. Let's just discuss a little bit more. You mentioned why did you decide to focus on six figures or five figures, but one at the university, five figures and their libraries? I mean, was that, like you said, just a literary device, or was that something that was, what was the reasoning for that exact idea?
Okay, it's a great question. It's more than a literary device, although it is a device for which I was personally inspired by one of the figures in the library is Harry Wilson. In his book on philosophy of Spinoza, if you recall, the subtitle of the book is, see if I remember it, it's recreating the, unlocking the latent processes of his reasoning, I believe. What he did was to try to recreate Spinoza's library and see what did he know, what did he study, and therefore we can now gauge what directions that gave him for creativity and what he added to it that was novel. So we took that device and we took individuals. There are also some other smaller libraries that are sort of scattered throughout, Professor Alman, the Rambam, others. But these are the main foci. And we concentrated on these figures, A, because they're inherently interesting figures, but also because they represent in their work these specific traits that are identified in the book, very much so. If you look, I mentioned there's also, a good example, the Rambam is part of, he is mentioned a couple of times in imagined scenarios. He would be a good example. He certainly expresses the principle of respect for precedent combined with creativity and critique. There's no question. He himself says at one point in his letter to Rav Pinchas, Lo kidmani adam, nobody before me has compiled a sefer of psak that is as comprehensive, not since Rebbe, he says. So he's well aware of the chidush in his work. It was Rav Aaron of Lunel who said, no one since the time of the Mishnah has composed such a unique work. At the same time, the Rambam uses all the sources that are at his disposal. It's an encyclopedic knowledge of Talmudic work, Gaonic work, Spanish literature, and also the philosophic sciences of the surrounding environment. He relies on that. There is a respect for precedence. He builds upon the foundation of that encyclopedic erudition, and then he's creative and critical accordingly. He also, when it comes to all the other, try to say briefly, but when it comes to the primacy of education, the Rambam wrote the book on that. If you look at Hilchos Tamid Torah, especially Perek Aleph, there is the imperative to teach everyone, no matter who that person is in Klal Yisrael, to make sure, as he puts in Hilchos Tshuva, that they reach ultimately kafi kocham, the level of Avas Hashem, which requires great knowledge. When it comes to logic and intellectual honesty in the pursuit of truth. Certainly the Rambam, just look at many times, but the Akdamah to Sefer Mitzvahs, where he explains that he only wrote Sefer Mitzvahs because he wanted to preface the Mishnah Torah with a list of Tayag Mitzvahs, but the first person who would see it would dismiss the whole Mishnah Torah because they would see that his list disagrees with prior authorities, and such is the nature of people who are by nature conservative and reactionary, that they'll judge his writing just on the basis of whether it agrees with previous authorities without critically analyzing, without using intellectual honesty in their search and pursuit of truth. And finally, when it comes to purposeful life, the Rambam, just look at the last chapter of the Mor Nevuchim, where he sets out the goal of Haskel V'Yadoasi, as he quotes Yirmiyah, to reach the level of intellectual apprehension of Hashem. And then even that goal, which should really guide one's purpose in life, purposeful living, even that is a self-transcending goal because he says, as the rest of the pasuk from Yirmiyahu reads, "Kini Hashem osa chesed u'mishpat tzedakah ba'aretz," so that you can then take that intellectual apprehension that you have achieved, that great shleimus when it comes to spiritual intellectual achievement, and then bring it down to emulate on earth, ki yinei Hashem osa chesed tzedakah u'mishpat ba'aretz, which is the even the highest level of moral perfection based on, anchored in, intellectual achievement. So here you have the Rambam as one example. I think all of the figures I mentioned, virtually all that we sort of reimagined in terms of the libraries, would reflect and mirror those key salient traits of the Jewish intellectual tradition.
And I would point out, and maybe you want to talk a little bit more about this, that each one of these, it's not merely what you were saying. I mean, you went through, for example, with Rav Hirsch, you suddenly start talking about the historical backdrop where they are, you explain the history of yeshiva, you explain other things are discussed there, the Vilna Gaon, so there's a lot of other figures that are discussed in each chapter. So it's not merely like, you know, the library of one of these figures, and then we just literally focused on what you thought they had in their library and what it was and what you point. So you do discuss, I don't know if you want to explain a little bit more to listeners what each chapter does. And then, like you said, Sometimes there's even in like italics, there are parts of the chapter where you imagine what the figure, interesting why you know, we could talk about why you decided to do that, or what a figure was thinking or what intellectually at the time. But so you did go. So again, maybe you wanted to talk about a little bit and just like just give an example, a little bit more of an overall one of these, the first six chapters.
Okay. There are many examples. That's an excellent point. Yes, each one of these figures is intended not only to reflect the salient traits of the tradition vertically throughout Jewish history, but also to reflect what's going on in their own time. So we have a better understanding of Jewish history of that particular period and the dynamics of the relationship between Jewish culture and the surrounding cultural environment in each one of these cases. And as I mentioned previously, the libraries give you a chance to explore directions for further creativity based on what's sitting on the shelves of the library, and also the possibility of potential conflicts. So just to give one small example, if you look at Rosh Mulhan Nagid's library, all of a sudden what we're finding, and this is very new, is that you have works of Piyot. Shmuel HaNagid was one of the greatest poets as well when it came to both liturgical poetry, Piyot, and secular poetry. But secular poetry was new at that time. Jews did not engage in it. That was an adaptation of a model from the surrounding Arabic environment. And that was on his shelf. On his bookshelves were works, that is manuscripts, in Arabic, in fields like philosophy and philology and poetry. So here you can see, and we try to chronicle this, how he himself is adapting and integrating something new, because there's an inherent tension between the tradition of liturgical poetry and the tradition of secular poetry. Liturgical poetry is all Shirei Kodesh. The content is Kodesh. And the person who writes the poetry is serving as the Shliach Tzibur on behalf of Klal Yisrael. But that's not the case in secular poetry. The themes can be quite secular. And the individual poet is expressing his individual desires and he's not at all playing the role of spokesman for the community and conveying the shevach, bakash, and hodah of the community to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's not his job. So here was an inherent tension, and the question was how to balance this, how to integrate it, and Shmuel HaNagid is doing that in his library. This scenario plays itself out in many different ways, in many different disciplines, and in many different periods and geographical eras throughout Jewish history. And I think these libraries help the reader to appreciate that, because all of those tensions and all of those creative integrations have had their impact on Jewish culture down to our own day.
So I just want to elaborate a little bit on what Rabbi Shmuel talked about what's in each chapter. So you're correct that we provide a historical context to the chapter to try to understand what's going on in society and Jewish life at the time. So the contribution to the intellectual tradition can be understood in the context of where the figure was geographically and historically. We then focus on one primary figure. And when Rabbi Shmuel referred to literary device, it's not the selection of the primary figure that's a literary device, because that figure is meant to be a paradigm of what was going on, but it's the libraries that are literary device per se. And then we talk about other great authorities and intellectuals in that period. Following that discussion of the history and the library and perhaps other contributors, we then review each of the genres and what was going on at that time. So there's a section on creative writing, a section on medicine and science, a section on philology, a section on philosophy, a section on Talmud, and a section on Torah study. And if you want to try to understand what was going on in each of those fields throughout the Jewish intellectual tradition, you then sort of have to read longitudinally, which is, say, read the Torah study section in each of the six chapters to get a sense of how things were moving historically. And so each chapter, as Rabbi Shmuel said, is more than just a library or one figure. It's trying to look at a snapshot of where the intellectual tradition was during that era, what the outside influences were on it, what the major controversies were, and how it related to previous eras and how it presaged the future.
So let me ask, how did you both decide on which specific figure you were going to choose for each of these major figures? How was that decision come about?
So I can't tell you we used an algorithm. we wanted to take people who would be interesting and also representative. And we had some discussions about whom do we pick in this era? And the ones we picked, Rabbi Shimon referred to, were people who had, we thought had impact on the intellectual tradition, but also were captivating figures. We could have certainly picked other people too. And as I said, you're right. There was a lively debate about, who are we going to pick in the 20th century? Well, you know, there were a lot of choices.
Yeah, that's quite correct. There's an all-star lineup of individuals who unfortunately did not make it into the book, but that in no way lessens their importance.
Right. Obviously, you had to select certain things. You couldn't have the book be about everyone. And like you said, there are in these chapters about these, each one you picked a specific figure, you do discuss many other figures in those chapters as well.
That's
so it's
correct.
Not just these five figures. Okay. So let me turn to you, Dr. Kadish, pick up back on what you were saying earlier about part two. So then you come to part two, which you entitled From Text to Success, Salient Ideas and Values and Their Influence. So there's an introduction, and then you go through various chapters. I'll read off the title to listeners: Respect for Precedent and Critical Independence, Logical Reasoning and Pursuit of Truth, The Primacy of Education, A Purposeful Life, The Pursuit of Perfection, and Summary and Conclusion. So you go through your points. So maybe just talk a little bit, explain to listeners what, you obviously talked a little bit about this before, but expound a little bit more on what part two does and what does it discuss?
So it tries to discuss what we consider these crucial principles that are part of the Jewish intellectual tradition. And so in part two, we first describe what we mean about that principle. So, for example, I talked a little bit about this earlier, respect for precedent, but encouraging creative thinking. Anyone who studied in a yeshiva or studied Gemara or in a learning group understands what that means, which is we don't contradict things in the Chumash or by previous authorities, but we always try to first, find new creative ideas, and second, apply those ideas in terms of meaning to what we're experiencing today, which is part of the idea that the Torah is eternal. We then, within each of those chapters, try to develop additional points. So, for example, in the chapter about respect for precedent and encouraging creative thinking, we talk about how different authorities have viewed that tension a little bit differently. So how much can we overturn? How much can we question? What's fixed and what's not? When is precedent absolutely inviolate? And when can precedent be changed a little bit and modified? And one of the things we do is contrast that sort of idea of respect to precedent and creative thinking with, let's say, the U.S. Supreme Court, which has a strong respect for precedent, but also encourages and requires new ideas. And one of the points we make is that in the Jewish intellectual tradition, as opposed to the Western intellectual tradition, say, the balance is a little bit different. So in the Jewish intellectual tradition, I would say, despite the tremendous encouragement we give to creativity, that precedent has a greater role than it does in the Western intellectual tradition, where there's more of an ability to overturn precedent. But sometimes that ability to overturn precedent can result in creativity, but sometimes it can result in ignoring intellectual achievements of the past. And we cite several examples in science and other fields where major advances, such as the theory of relativity, were actually based on looking back at prior work. And as revolutionary and creative as the theory of relativity was, it was based on some controversies that were a couple of hundred years old, which Einstein looked at it in a different way. So in that chapter, we try to look at that conflict between precedent and creativity, see how it's played out among different authorities in the Jewish intellectual tradition. And in our view, try to strike a balance between respect for precedent and creativity that allows creative thinking, allows the application of Torah to modern society, but doesn't overturn the principles on which the Jewish intellectual tradition is based. And so that's one chapter and the examples of where we looked at things in that chapter. In the pursuit chapter on the pursuit of truth, using logic in the pursuit of truth, we talked about what's the truth. Everybody believes that we should be pursuing truth, but how do we define truth? Is it a practical application of truth? Is it a philosophical application of truth? Is it a historical application of truth? And this whole concept of what is truth, obviously, in today's society, has become complicated. You know, there are some people who believe that there are no absolute truths. And so that's why the idea of the Jewish intellectual tradition about using logic in the pursuit of truth is very timely. And so we talk a little bit about that as well. In the chapter on literacy, we contrast the Jewish tradition of literacy with others, but we also talk about how that's important for education, and how literacy, even today, where in some societies like the American, like American society, there's close to universal literacy, but the approach to education and literacy still differs a little bit. And finally, in the chapter on a purposeful life, we try to deal with the questions of what is the purpose of life? What are the different approaches to the purpose of life within the Jewish tradition? And then talk about, present some data that I showed you earlier, that I talked about earlier, which is that people who live a purposeful life are happier and more productive. So that's the most of the second part of the book. And in the final chapter, as Rabbi Schmidt and I have both talked about, we talk about lessons for education. And things like that may not be kind of so popular today, which is acquire a mentor and learn from them. As Rabbi Schmidman said, he was a Talmud of the Rav. To surround yourself with books, and you know they can be electronic, but surround yourself with books. Respect scholars. Think logically about things, and live a life to elevate yourself and others. And that's what we think the Jewish intellectual tradition has been about. And that's why we think it's been so resilient. And that's why we think it's been so productive, because as Rabbi Schmidman said, in the scope of the book, we talk about, you know, things that many of the figures are familiar to lots of people. But, you know, sort of Emil Durkheim, the father of sociology, came from an observant home. Freud had more of a relationship to Judaism than some historians have given him credit for, despite the fact that he was probably personally a kofer and atheist. We talk about how Einstein's work and others were influenced by the Jewish tradition. And finally, we talk about how disruptive thinking in modern society plays out of this creativity idea in the Jewish intellectual tradition. How some Talmudic reasoning, despite its respect for precedent, leads to disruptive thinking, and how so many of the disruptive thinkers in the information age have been Jewish and influenced by the Jewish intellectual tradition. And, you know, companies like Facebook and Google, you know, had a strong Jewish influence, even if the founders and directors weren't, and Intel, you know, had a strong Jewish influence, even if the founders and directors weren't observant. And so we talk about how that disruptive thinking idea has continues to have an influence today on intellectual achievement.
I also want to mention that there are also in the back after this, before the end notes, there are some, there's a few appendixes, a few maps, which are nice. It late to tell, you know, the Jews of Spain and Portugal, the Jews of Germany, so people can see where, you know, historically what was going on. I think that's nice that you included that in the book. So I think finally, who would you say the book is geared towards? Who were you aiming this book towards?
So look, we think that most of the readers will be Jewish or people who are very interested in the Jewish tradition. We could have written sort of a more popular book, say, which just had, you know, an I'm okay, you're okay kind of book, which is this is what you should do. But And we might have gotten a few more readers, but we thought that would miss a lot of what we were trying to accomplish, which is to teach people about the richness of the Jewish intellectual tradition and why it's been successful and why it's persisted and why we think it's been so much a part of Judaism's persistence and resilience. And so it's a book for serious readers, but it's a book for observant Jews, non-observant Jews, and people who are interested in understanding more about Judaism.
And it's a book that American society could use at this point in time, perhaps more so than in many decades.
Okay, now, following up on that, I mean, what is there a specific, I guess, what do you hope to accomplish with this book? Is there a specific thing, or is it just like you were saying, Dr. Kate, it's just that people should just be more cognizant of the tradition? What would you say the goal was?
No, we think that the principles that we elucidated here should affect the way we do education. And it affects the way we think about education at Turo. And we think that it can affect the way that people think about education throughout society. And the educational system in the United States, both the yeshiva system and the other system, is complicated and is struggling, particularly in the age of COVID. And I think everybody would agree that the public school system could use some changes. And I think the yeshiva system is being faced with a lot of challenges, and making sure that we don't lose sight of the core principles that have kept us successful all along, we thought was very important. So we think there's a real, it's not just an intellectual interest book. We think there's a real practical importance to try to understand this. And we actually have developed a course at Turo called The Jewish Intellectual Tradition. For the second, moving to our third semester, and the course is oversubscribed. And we're thinking about putting it out there more publicly so that more people can learn about it and benefit from it.
Wow, fascinating. And I'm going to put a link to in the show's notes to the book at Academic Studies Press is where you can purchase from. And we'll tell the listeners, I don't know if the link will pop up automatically, hardcover for $100-something. It is available in paperback for $28. So there's two options. So, you know, I don't know, sometimes it doesn't, you know, it is, like I said, $28 is available in paperback. Okay. One thing I think we did kind of, this was alluded to throughout, but I guess I should just ask it finally, is that, so each of you brought, I guess, unique, your own perspective. What did each of you like contribute in the book? Was it that Rabbi Schmidman did the historical part and Dr. Kadish, you did the part two, or wasn't such a neat split? It was, you both worked on this together, but each bringing different viewpoints of things.
We worked on everything together. Every chapter is a collaboration.
Yes.
The conception of what we were going to put in, how the writing was done, what we thought would interest people, was a collaborative effort. And it was also a constant challenge between complexity, completeness, readability, and getting the message across. And so so I think working together, we got to a place we were happy with. But if you ask me who did the majority of writing, Michael probably did the majority of the writing, but I probably did the majority of the editing. But we both wrote sections and edited sections. So,
And it should be underscored that this is Dr. Kadish's vision in terms of the structure, the salient characteristics of the Jewish intellectual tradition, and the possibility of universal application that led to what I think people would really gain from. I hope they read the whole book, but they should especially read chapter 11 with the specific recommendations as to how to apply these principles in practice, whether it's chavrusa learning, cooperative learning, which goes back to Jewish intellectual tradition, whether it's respect for books and scholars. We quote there from Professor Alman when it comes to the importance of books. He was asked on a radio show in Israel. Here he was, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, and he was asked why so many Jews, disproportionate number of Jews, received Nobel Prize crisis. And he says, well, Jews grow up with books that are filled with rooms that are filled with books and houses that are filled with bookcases. That's one of the contributing factors.
Okay, very interesting. So thank you both for joining me. And like I said, listeners can check it out. I'll put the link to the book will be in the show's notes.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
Thank you.